Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Hello and welcome back to Breaking Banks. This is a special episode of Breaking Banks this week. My apologies, I've got a bit of a cold, but winter is upon us. This week I wanted to share with you some of our favorite interviews from the episodes we've done in 2014. Now, these were chosen by my producer. This is the producer's cut. Of course, I did have some input into that, but I think these episodes characterize what is best about Breaking Banks and what makes this such an interesting radio show. Now, first up is an interview that we did with Chris Withers from IBM Watson team, and we followed that interview with James Barrett, an author of the book called Our Final Invention. IBM Watson's doing some incredible work to get Watson ready to be a financial advisor, but in this episode, Chris also talks about IBM Watson's work in the field of cancer diagnosis. Now, the hope is that technology like Watson will democratize the system and make information and decision-making accessible to everyone with consistency and high quality. But James Barrett, he had a darker view of AI and how we might be creating machines that will literally outthink us and maybe out-human us. Listen to the interviews, see what you think.
Very, very interesting, the whole machine learning and the natural language processing capability that you built into Watson. But tell us specifically about what's happening in the financial services space. I know you mentioned the research into cancer and the diagnosis stuff, but you've been doing some work recently with DBS and USAA. Tell us about how Watson's being used there and how successful it's been.
Yeah. So just recently, USAA have gone live with a consumer-facing application which uses Watson. So, as you probably know, USAA serves the military community, and there's a lot of people who are transitioning from military to civilian life. So one of the first use cases that USAA have released through their USAA.site and mobile app is an advisor, really, which can give guidance to those vets who are transitioning. So the kind of question they might ask is, can I be in the reserves and still collect my veteran benefits? You know, there's a myriad of stuff around that. So what USAA and IBM together did was we ingested about 3,000 documents which detail all of the things that pertain to transitioning to civilian life, that could be where to live, all of those kinds of information. So for such an important life event for those military vets, they've now got this kind of question and answer service provided by USAA, sort of powered by Watson, where they can ask any question. And they're really interesting dialogues people will have with it. And if Watson doesn't know the question, it'll ask someone to rephrase it. But you find that the vets using it have a really good, strong interaction with it. So I think we're both really pleased with it. So that's the first consumer-facing one. So we also worked with DBS in Singapore, and that's at the other end of the spectrum. Really. They're serving high net worth individuals. So this is where they're using Watson to help their relationship managers analyze the masses of documents that come out from the investment office, such, research reports and so on, product information about the products and services that they offer, as well as analyze customer profiles. And what Watson's doing there is analyzing those and then using that to help arm the relationship managers with advice on what they should be, when they speak to their clients.
And I think giving the advisors advice, don't you love that?
Exactly, because a bit like the cancer example, and often the oncology advisor is quite seen as a very similar analogy, particularly in wealth management. The interesting thing is Watson gives you the evidence behind the answer. So for quite a lot of deterministic systems, which are business rules, you'll get an answer popped out. But when Watson gives an answer, it also gives the evidence behind it. So that's, I think, really interesting for use cases, right the way along from USAA through up to, high net worth clients at DBS, because people are interested in the rationale behind things, and that's what Watson's doing, because when it's found an answer, it's found it because it's looked through documents and it's scored that information. So it thinks this and it thinks this for this reason. So it gives that the consumers and the relationship managers that extra piece of information as to why they think that's a good piece of guidance or recommendation.
There's an interesting element here. We saw recent news, I'm a little skeptical about this, but there was I think it was MIT or one of these guys had an algorithm that had passed the Turing test for the first time. And there's an element of this where once we get these machines learning or to a sufficient capability in terms of the ability to absorb information, process it, and put it back as advice, that advice can really compete in terms of the value of it compared with the advice you'd get from a human advisor. Is this really where I think, are we starting to see constructs like Watson being used to help us get smarter, to augment our decision-making process? Is that a large portion of where your investment is going into this interface?
So I think the use cases that we see, so USAA is a good example of where they've trained Watson, but it was their people and their expert advisors really who trained it, such that their customers can come on and ask questions directly of Watson. So in that case, they're answering the questions directly to a machine and it's coming back with the answers. But as the information changes or some new information comes in, you still need the advisors, the human advisors, to interpret that and to train Watson. What Watson really gives USAA in that respect is, it's accessible in the way that digital is, so it's accessible 24/7. You know, Watson doesn't go to sleep. And I think the other thing we find is people are much more willing to ask what they consider sort of stupid questions to machines rather than to humans. So there's that element of not feeling that you're being judged when you speak to a machine. But also it's very scalable, so you can scale it out at very low marginal cost compared to advice in a different way. But just as in DBS, I think there will, and the same for oncology as well, Watson is really in that respect providing augmentation and decision support for those sort of professions where there's just an information overload. So it's just impossible for those doctors to read everything that's going on, and the same with the relationship managers with all the investment advice and financial news that's out there. So I think we see these cases across the spectrum.
So, right now you're working on this, you said across the spectrum, but I find it really interesting that as the machine learns and as the quality of the answers get better, then, you're not really going to be able to beat the advice that Watson could give you in a particular setting, particularly for, like in the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule. 80% of the time, it's probably going to get better advice. One of the problems you have with wealth managers, for example, is you take a wealth manager at HSBC, they got 50,000 potential products that they can recommend across the, all the different asset classes. They can't possibly know even 1% of that product base. But Watson could. So this is finding that right product. We've always, I think, had a romantic view about this as bankers, that an advisor in a bank will be able to give you the right advice. But with this sort of capability, I would question whether an advisor could really compete with something like Watson once it's up to speed in terms of the quality of matching the right product to you at the right time. Very interesting.
Yeah, I think it is really interesting. And I think so there's that aspect of, of the way that Watson's being used today at USAA and DBS. But I think the other interesting area that we see is radically kind of changing the user experience. So at USAA, obviously, there are, people are asking questions of it. But we also see in that same way that this kind of idea of the financial concierge, where instead of the way that we have to interact with most sort of digital across any industry now is filling out forms, clicking search, interpreting the answers. The ability to actually speak to a computer in the way that we're speaking now in natural language and get it to execute things for you. So perhaps in the PFM space, you might want to say, show me the receipt for the washing machine I bought at Best Buy last year. And the machine intelligence there would say, look back through and say, well, you didn't buy a washing machine from Best Buy, but you did buy a tumble dryer from Walmart, and that's close enough, and maybe that's what you mean. or if you're offered a product, say an insurance product, before you buy it, you might want to know, does it cover me for skiing, if it's a, you know, travel insurance policy? So that ability to kind of interact with, in the way that you speak things and get actually actions kicked off, which could be, you know, add my partner to my insurance policy. That's, I think, another interesting area that we see. So that ability to use natural language, that ability to use that machine learning to actually kick off your business processes, really, that you have in your everyday sort of financial life, and provide that sort of financial virtual assistant or concierge.
So we had a question from Peter Olnick. Peter is in Charlotte, and he works for Carlo and Gallagher. And he asked, does this place most current banking jobs at risk? But I think what you're saying is that still for the medium term, there is still synergy in, someone helping Watson learn, and B, working with this side by side.
Yeah, I think we will find that smart machines like Watson will be there to support us. I mean, as you know, across the ages, there's always been sort of concerns about machines taking over sort of our jobs, from the loom right the way through to the combustion engine. And, you know, our view is very much that really what we've got out there at the moment is this massive big data. It's, you know, our chief exec calls it the great new natural resource. There's just so much of it. And from that data, you've got incredible value. And we've seen that through some of the businesses, both in fintech, but also in other sectors that use this data that's out there. And I think our view would be very much that there's so much data out there that you can't process it as a human, but actually machines like Watson will help you do that, and through that they'll create new jobs and different jobs, but they'll be leveraging this big data that's out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms next for Watson, where do you see this going over the next couple of years?
Yep, so I think some of the things that, you know, we talked about around making accessible through mobile devices and providing that evidence base. You know, just recently we actually announced a new product where, rather than there being a right answer in the data that Watson ingests, and something called a discovery advisor, which is going to initially again be used in life sciences, but to help sort of accelerate the pace of scientific breakthroughs. So the example that we gave was we worked with Baylor College of Medicine and analyzed 70,000 documents around a specific protein that causes cancer. And I think over the last 20 years or so, the average protein that someone's discovered that might actually affect this, that might be a solution for this type of cancer, has been one a year. But Watson ingesting this found 6 potential proteins to be investigated. Wow. Again, using in life sciences, and what Watson's doing there is understanding, if you like, the language of science, but you can see how that could be applicable in financial analysis, in fraud and AML and so on. So we certainly see, you know, Watson advancing in that way and actually being used in more of those research areas.
Extremely efficient decision-making processes, particularly when it involves crunching data to come up with a conclusion.
Yeah, and it's, again, it's, I guess at the root of all this is there's just so much digital data out there now. The content that we produce, but also that shadow data from all of the information, or, you know, from our digital lives of where we are, mobile data and so on. So again, it's wherever there's a kind of information overload, there's probably a role for a machine like Watson to actually help and support the human in whatever role that they're doing, as well as create, you know, completely new businesses. So it's a fascinating time.
Great. All right, so let's see if we can introduce James into the session now. James, are you on?
I am.
Welcome to the show. James Barrett, the author of Final Invention, Our Final Invention.
Thanks very much for having me. It's great to be here, good. Brett.
Great. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about, you're a documentary filmmaker. How did you get into this area of artificial intelligence and machine intelligence?
Well, I did a film about artificial intelligence years ago, and I interviewed Ray Kurzweil, who's a great proponent of AI and a very kind of utopian view of the future. And I interviewed Rodney Brooks, who's the sort of world's premier roboticist. Both of those guys were really optimistic about sharing the planet with smarter than human machines. But then I interviewed Arthur C. Clarke, who had been a scientist before he was a science fiction writer. And he was much more pessimistic, and that really got me thinking about some of the downsides of advanced artificial intelligence.
Well, you know, this is we see a lot of this fear-mongering that the machines are going to take over, the Terminator concept and things like that. But, you know, we don't really know what how machine intelligence are going to think, because by their nature already we're seeing things like Watson with its learning algorithms process information differently and think differently. So aren't we applying very human psychologies to this problem?
I think in the short term, the risk of advanced artificial intelligence in the short term, it's going to be in the hands of those who control it. In the long term, it's going to be whether or not we can control advanced artificial intelligence or not. I think right now we're seeing AI being used in very productive and interesting ways, like Watson. Although I do think we have to look closely at the disruption that's going to be caused by these machines and jobs. We have to look much more closely at that. But I think right now we can see advanced AI and data mining has been abused here in the United States by the NSA. You know, they siphoned off all that data. You know, we're talking about the ocean of data that we've got at our disposal now. Well, the NSA, the National Security Agency, was funneling off all our phone calls and our emails. And from that, they were getting my address book and probably yours. And in the process, stepping all over the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits illegal search and seizure without probable cause. So they were seizing that stuff illegally, but they could only do it because they were using advanced data mining software.
Right. So without some learning capability or the ability to suck in huge amounts of data and process it, then they wouldn't have had that capability.
I think exactly. And I think that it's about the challenge ahead of us now is who controls the AI. I think when you're using it for you know, right now I know Watson is taking the federal medical licensing exam so that it can become a medical diagnostician. I think that's terrific to assist with doctors, and it's going to be doing business analytics.
So, Chris, I'll just ask Chris to jump in here. Chris, are we going to have to get to sit the FINRA Series 66 or Series 6 exams or whatever they are soon?
That'd be fun, wouldn't it?
It would be. Sorry, James. This is we were talking about the financial services impact before, but go ahead.
Sure. No, I think all that's very positive. I think, a report came out recently from MIT that 48% of jobs that exist right now are going to be displaced by automation and AI in the next 20 years.
Yeah.
So I think we have to, you know, this is a little bit different from the first machine age. You know, there's an excellent book I recommend to everybody besides my book, Our Final Invention, but it's called The Second Machine Age.
Right.
And it talks a lot about
the Luddites and, you know, these guys who are disrupted by early machine automation.
Right. Yes. I think that this, the information age is different really in kind than that. You know, steam power was, you know, its power and efficiency increased in a slow way. You know, it doubled every 70 years. Computer power doubles every 18 months, and it gets increases by a factor of 10 every 5 years. So it's a different, you know, I think
as long as Moore's law holds.
Yeah, well, with Google getting into quantum computing, I think Moore's law is going to be left in the dust pretty soon.
Absolutely.
So I think we have to keep an eye on that. We have to keep an eye on who's controlling the ways that we use the data and manipulate the data, and how are we gathering the data.
Okay. Very interesting. All right, so let's take a quick break. Okay, you're listening to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We have James Barrett, the author of Our Final Invention and a documentary filmmaker, and Chris Withers from the IBM Watson team talking artificial and machine intelligence. We'll be right back after this quick break.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees. And all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here. And it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Move In is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Move In today.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's kony.com/BK. You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. We're in the second segment now of our favorite interviews of 2014. Now, this segment, we have a couple of interviews regarding emerging markets. The first interview is with Ben Lyons from CopoCopo, talking about the mobile payment scene in Africa and how that's exploding. And to underpin sort of that theme, we also have an interview from Costa Peric from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who points out that there's incredible potential in banking, potentially 1 billion people in Africa on mobile phones over the next few years. Check out what these guys had to say about the future of the banking industry in emerging markets like Africa. Talking about mobile payments, let's talk about one of the most advanced economies in the world in respect to this. We're very delighted to have with us right here in the New York studio today, Ben Lyon from CopoCopo. Ben, say hello.
Hey, thanks for having me, Brett.
So you have this new platform, really, for business. So there was the Economist article a while back that it said that it was close to a third of Kenya's GDP went through the M-Pesa network. So if you're looking for a platform for merchants and funding and lending and all of those things, it's quite obvious. It's certainly superior to the traditional bank network. So tell me, how are merchants working with CopoCopo and getting access to funding, and how's this helping the Kenyan economy and at a grassroots level merchants who are day to day looking for financing and so forth?
Yeah, I think first just a general comment on kind of the mobile payment landscape in Africa. I think it's mostly, if not all, in Africa. There are now 9 countries where, and you were tweeting about this the other day, there are now 9 countries where there are more mobile wallets than there are bank accounts. You have to ask yourself the question, what is banking anyway? It's a store of value. It's a way to send and receive money, maybe a place to store your value. And a lot of that's being accomplished through these prepaid mobile wallets. So when we entered Kenya, this was now late 2010, we noticed a disparity in the payments ecosystem, which was Safaricom had been focusing very extensively on the domestic remittance market and on issuing wallets, quote unquote issuing SIM cards to its subscribers, because telcos really get consumers. But what they hadn't done at the time was actually the other side of a payments ecosystem. They hadn't acquired merchants to accept that value. So you had this conundrum, which was about 7 out of 10 Kenyan adults were walking around on the streets with value on their phones, or with the capacity to have value on their phones, and less than 1,000 merchants in a market where there are hundreds of thousands of merchants would let you pay for it.
Right.
So we said, you know, after learning that, deciding not to focus on microfinance and to kind of turn to SMEs and retail, we approached Safaricom and suggested, why don't you let us try and go and acquire some merchants and see what happens? And that was early 2012. The results were instantaneous and positive. And what was clear was that there was a consumer demand at a national and growing, you know, level to pay with M-Pesa at the point of sale. And so, you know, the best way to think about what CopoCopo does is we are to Safaricom, to M-Pesa, what Square is to Chase Payment Tech in the U.S. We're a merchant aggregator for one, and we're going out identifying, acquiring, branding, training, supporting, and reconciling and settling merchants, as well as building value-added services on top of it. So 2012 was our first kind of, you know, our right hook. Our left hook was kind of now in the shadow banking type sector, where we launched a cash advance service, a merchant cash advance service, that rewarded our merchants for volume that they would process through us. And so we would say, you know, based on your volume and volatility over X period, we'll extend you an unsecured cash advance of Y amount, ranging from $12 to $58,000, which you can access in less than 24 hours. And that's kind of the left hook, the new service that we've just launched to start using mobile payments as the first kind of, you know, as the foundation, the rails, and then start building on an ecosystem, a business ecosystem, on top of those rails.
Yeah, I'm just looking at that article that was posted in PC Tech, and it comes from, it says Tech Moran, but here's the figures. As of June 2013, so that's last year, it's sure to be even more updated now, but 98 million of the 203 million registered mobile money accounts globally were in Africa. There are 9 countries today: Kenya, Tanzania, Cameroon. What are the other ones? It doesn't list the other ones. They're the 3 new countries. But we had John Owens, I don't know, from the African Financial Inclusion Group on a couple, while back. And we had also Costa Peric from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And we often talk about this. But, you know, the fact is, base fact is, we have 9 countries where they have more mobile money accounts today than traditional bank accounts. This must be the fastest ever shift in financial inclusion that we've ever seen in banking ever, historically, in terms of such a rapid turnaround of enabling people to get access to basic mobile, basic money and banking services. It's pretty amazing.
Even actually, when you look at relative to the population, the speed that M-Pesa disseminated. In 6-7 years, they now serve about 80% of the adult population. So I think it's actually one of the fastest technology adoptions ever relative to a national population.
So in respect to mobile adoption, we still got a lot of feature phones there. I know Nokia's had some considerable success with their rich feature phone that they've launched in the market recently. But what's the makeup? Do you see that changing as well? More and more people moving into rich feature phones or smartphones in these markets as well?
Yes. It's, you know, we would say pole pole, so kind of gradual in East Africa, but that's definitely the arc of where the market's moving. I think, and don't quote me on this, I think it was a few months ago, Safaricom mentioned that something like over half of the phones that they're selling today are Android phones. And when you look in sub-Saharan Africa, it's definitely Android as opposed to iOS, but that's the future. What's been really beneficial with these systems and being rolled out by the telcos is that even if you don't have a smartphone, the systems like M-Pesa and MTN Mobile Money, Airtel Money, Ucash, Orange Money, etc., there are nearly 200 of these, if not more, across the global south. They're designed to work on SIM toolkits and via, you know, encrypted SMS on the unstructured supplementary service data or USSD channel. And so these are services that start at the very base, on the most basic phone. But now you're actually starting to see an evolution as well. Tigo Pesa in Tanzania has rolled out an Android application, Echo Cash in Zimbabwe. And so it is very much starting at the bottom and growing with the customer, where now you have this interesting tension where you see more and more of the telcos moving directly into the abode of banks, mimicking more and more of the interfaces, offering more ancillary financial services. The same kind of trend you see in India with the potential licensing of payments banks. And, of course, the banks are responding out of opportunity and fear and moving more into the telco space. So you see, like, Equity Bank in Kenya has now received a mobile virtual network operator license. Well, at the same time, Echo Cash in Zimbabwe or EchoNet Wireless has acquired a bank, Steward Bank. And so, you know, every day across Africa, this it becomes more and more difficult to actually differentiate between the two. And frankly, the customer doesn't care which it is, because, you know, a rose by any other name is a financial service.
Oh, it's very, very interesting, because if you extrapolate this out, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later in the show, but if you extrapolate this out in 10 years and you sort of try and think what the makeup of banking services might be like, you can sort of see where that's going with the lines blurring in terms of a bank and a telco and a mobile money provider versus a payments provider versus a merchant network. Mm-hmm. Now, you did mention there's a bit of flavors there. You know, we've got the M-Pesa, the MTEL, and others, that are out there. Is there moves towards trying to get interoperability, or is that not a big deal, transferring payments cross-border within Africa right now?
The answer is complicated, and it depends. And so you'll see when Bharti Airtel acquired Zain's Africa assets, one of the things Zain had been focused on was kind of the one network concept, which was that in any country in which you're a Zain customer, you should be able to call another Zain customer in any other country at a local rate. And one of the things they were trying that now Airtel is also entertaining is, why don't we apply that to money as well? So if you're an Airtel Money wallet holder in Tanzania, why shouldn't you be able to very quickly transfer money to an Airtel Money wallet holder in Rwanda? And so, you know, on the one case, they're looking at cross-border kind of transactions. I think we're still a few years out from that being common. And, of course, you would see that be quite regionalized along kind of the corridors of commerce. But in terms of interoperability on a domestic level, it depends on the country. In Tanzania, Airtel Money, Tigo Pesa, and Zantel Easy Pesa have come together to start building an interoperable network, whereas the market leader Vodacom M-Pesa is holding out, versus in Kenya now, where Safaricom is the dominant player with M-Pesa in the market. They're receiving tremendous pressure from the competition authority to open up. But when you look at the draft legislation, it says players are, quote, encouraged for interoperability. So, you know, it's systems over time, open systems win. Systems interoperate, standards are introduced. But I don't see that being something that happens quickly in these markets.
No, that's a good point. Just remember, if you're listening to the show, even if you're out in Africa, and I know we've got some listening from Africa today, we always do, and please feel free to tweet any questions you might have for Ben. We'll pick them up on the Twitter feed. Just use the hashtag #BreakingBanks, and we'll be happy to ask Ben any questions you might have. You can also dial in on our normal talkback number if you want to ask a question in person. So in respect to CopaCopo, you know, what sort of volume of business are you guys doing now? Tell us a bit about, you know, the size of the business and how that's grown over the last 12, 18 months.
Yeah. So we look at ourselves very much as a tech startup. And, you know, even when hopefully we achieve kind of massive adoption, we want to stay a tech startup. And so today we service about 15,000 businesses in Kenya. We're processing about $4 million a month in terms of actual payments volume. We've just introduced this Grow product. We've recently lent our millionth dollar to our customers. So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, we're still quite small. But it's also kind of a new industry. In the last 27 months, we started this in 2012, we have experienced kind of strong month-over-month growth. So it's very much a long game. We look at it like an ultramarathon. But it takes time for the markets to come together. And, you know, of course, bear in mind, we've started in Kenya where it's the most mature and robust, and the other markets are just starting to come online. One of our theories, though, as a company, our hypothesis is that mobile money as a form factor is the payment card of the global south. And in the same way that you had merchant acquiring and value-added services solutions kind of built about around the payment card industry, you will have, whether it's us or someone else, the same around that form factor.
It sounds like it's mimicking that. It's just that
it is.
It's a new network. So great. Listen, we're just going to go to a quick break, guys. You're with Breaking Banks. Ben Lyon from CopoCopo is here. We're talking sub-Saharan Africa, mobile payments, mobile money, mobile banking. Joining us from all the way from Seattle is Costa Peric. I'll introduce him momentarily. But last week, I took a visit briefly, a couple of days, down to Mumbai in India. And, of course, the big topic there is financial inclusion. And there's been a lot of effort to try and reach outlying regions, outlying areas of India with branches. But one of the realizations that we've come to is actually we will never be able to achieve 100% financial inclusion with a branch-based model. Is we now have a number of countries where we, in fact, have more accounts held on a mobile phone than we do in a traditional bank account. So leading the charge on some of this, of course, is organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, of which Costa leads their efforts in the financial services space. Costa, we first met, of course, through InnerTribe when you were at Swift. And I remember the first time we actually sat down and got to spend some time together was in Cannes in France. You remember that?
I do remember indeed.
Very good. So tell us about you fairly recently joined the Gates Foundation. Tell us about what you're doing there and your role.
Thank you, Brett, and welcome to all. Yes, I have joined in September, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, after a long tenure at Swift, where I was mostly focusing on technology. And I joined essentially to support the efforts on what we call the FSP, Financial Services for the Poor. And we are a group of people who focus on a number of areas on the globe that are the most populous and the poorest, indeed with the view that financial inclusion is important and that the poor people that we want to help, and let me define quickly what we mean by that. We really mean people and families who live on less than $2 per day, $2 per day. And they are in excess of 3 billion people in that condition today.
So why is it, in your estimation, that the mobile phone has become so critical in respect to an enabler, in recent times, particularly with what we've seen in the Philippines and in places like Kenya? Why has the mobile been an important part of this move to financial inclusion?
Yeah, the key issue to be solved, Brett, is access. So we have made also some very interesting studies of actually geospatial mapping of financial access points, such as bank branches or postal offices in the countries I focus on, Nigeria, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Indonesia. And you can see that in some cases, people have to actually walk for 30, 40 miles to actually get access to a financial, because simply there is lack of access, there is lack of branches, there is lack of financial cash-in and cash-out points. And so that is the key issue. Now, on the other hand, these people do have access to mobile phone technology and coverage in many, many cases. And so that's kind of like just 2 plus 2 equals 4 equation that went that is underlying, you know, the access equation. So indeed, the current banking system, branch-based, as you mentioned in the beginning, is just not reaching out. I explained the problem with the size of this problem with our geospatial mapping. So the question is, how do you roll out cash-in and cash-out points to this population? And it cannot be done with branches. So the one idea we are pushing, and notably, for example, in Bangladesh, there is a quite a nice success story so far.
With Bcash.
Yeah. Who are building quite an extensive agent network, and an agent is like a shop in a market or in a village that actually caters for being able to cash in to get mobile money on your account, or cash out from your mobile account back into cash. So that's very, very important, because that's the way that this works. So that's a notable success that we are sponsoring with grants. Another important thing also is we are working a lot with governments. There is a lot of payments that go from government to people in these countries related to subsidies for farmers, with health and social security. Right. And a lot of that is still done by cash today, and there is a lot of leakage, as we see it, where the actual money that gets in the hand of the person who should have actually gets only half of the money. So right. That's another big effort we are doing to digitize these payments, so that we reduce the leakage and we improve the time that it takes. In some cases, these payments, I've seen it in India, can take months. So as you can see, we employ a lot. We are a whole portfolio of different approaches to help.
Now, if we take markets like Bangladesh, not only access to the financial system has been important in terms of basic mobile money transfers and the ability to move cash around or store cash in a value store, in this case the phone, so you can save money. But one of the things that's been very important in that market is access to microcredit facilities. Right. So is this something you're involved in as well?
Well, we see. So indeed, we are. So my particular job in the foundation is to focus on these countries that have no platform yet. There are some. There a colleague of mine, Janine Furpo. She's focusing on these countries where there is that are more advanced on mobile money, notably Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. And there, indeed, we can see some additional financial instruments being created, such as Mshwari in Kenya, that runs on top of M-Pesa. That is indeed a savings and credit facility. So yes, but we go in kind of stages. We first have to deploy, you know, the basic platform for digital payments, and then you can build on top of that. That's the sequence of things.
How does building this alternative financial system, you know, based on mobile microcredit, things like that, how does that generally affect the economy of these developing nations, would you say?
We are building kind of a fact-based around that. So I don't have concrete numbers to share with you today. But from what emerges from our research is that there is a number of that the whole economy is actually driven up by digital money, and we can see it in Kenya, where that this economy actually creates jobs, notably the agents that we mentioned. So we can see that this new economy actually puts a lot of oil in the machine. But I can't share with you. It's too new yet. I can't share with you facts. So we
hard
see anecdotal evidence, and we invest a lot of research in this as well. Indeed.
Now, does this work particularly well in markets where there's a lot of remittance participation? You know, we've heard it before that in countries like Bangladesh and the Philippines, a large portion of their GDP now comes from foreign workers outside of the country sending money back. Is that where these systems work best, or do they work just as well in other developing economies where that's not the case?
The remittance topic is important and it's an important driver of the efforts for digital money. Interestingly, we see a lot of importance of remittances within countries. So, for example, within Bangladesh, there is really the west and east side, and there is a corridor of remittances between the two sides of the country, which actually drives quite a lot of, as well on the Bcash side of their business. And then, of course, there is the international remittances, topic, which, To be specific on at the moment, at least from the Gates Foundation side, this is a chapter of the book that we still have to open. Right now, as I mentioned, we're first focusing on kind of like intra-country platforms, but it is the obvious candidate for the next step as well.
Costa, I just want to go to a break right now. We'll be back right after this break. You're with Breaking Banks.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Moovin app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Moovin.com. That's Moovin.com.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the final segment of today's Breaking Banks. This is the best of show for 2014. Now, with the surge of investment in fintech, we're seeing a lot of places vie to be considered the financial technology center of the world. Right now, New York and London are seen as the major contenders. But as Uday Goyal pointed out in this interview that we're going to hear from today, this is still an open field, and the greatest innovations and the greatest growth in fintech may come from places that haven't been traditional centers of banking. It's time to keep our eyes on Africa, Southeast Asia, and places like this. This also ends with our very first, but far from our last, moment of snark by Mr. Snark himself, Ron Shevlin.
We are talking with David Rose, Matt Harris, and Pascal Bouvier from US, from New York and Washington, talking fintech based in New York, Silicon Alley. And the team representing Silicon Roundabout and EU generally is Uday Goyal and Claire Cockerton from Innovate Finance in the UK. So before the break, we were debating whether or not the regulatory environment of Europe is better for something like mobile payments versus the pure capitalist environment of the US, where Apple has been able to leverage their market dominance to sort of force the hand of the big banks. There was a FinExtra, I don't know whether you guys saw it, and it was the title of the article, I'm not going to be able to find it now. This is what normally happens. Was something like U.S. banks forced to pay a high price for cozying up to U.S. banks pay high price for cozying up to Apple Pay, and this was about the deal on the 15 basis points, commercial agreements that they have. Now, I commented on this in that article on FinExtra. I said, maybe the headline should read U.S. banks pay high price for being slow on EMV and mobile payments and having to outsource it to Apple. And I think that's, one of the things here is that, in the EU, with something like SEPA or Gyro, which are some great technologies that help in terms of bank-to-bank payments ecosystems and things like that, you have a mandated standard that gets put in place and everyone says, all right, yep, we'll do that. And then in the US, if you tried that same approach based on sort of the state and federal system, then you would have 80% of the room sort of put up their hand and say, no way, we're not going to do something that the federal government mandates us. Let us choose our own way. And then you get Venmo and PayPal and Dwala and, all these other schemas coming about, and you don't actually end up with a standard. So maybe Matt, you can jump in here. When in talking about sort of survival of the fittest and what David called this sort of Darwinian atmosphere, is the fact that the U.S. tends to look for these rising stars to get commercial dominance as a method rather than sort of creating standards, whereas something like host card emulation and tokenization is actually a pretty positive standard. Is that a negative for the U.S. in terms of particularly in this space of fintech where interoperability and standards around security and identity have to be fairly clear?
I think that there are pros and cons, and I'll articulate what I mean. I think that for a young company, it is more of a meritocracy. You are not going to be made the winner by the stroke of a government pen or by fiat. You're going to be made the winner by winning. Dwala has an opportunity through strength of will, good execution, outstanding value proposition, what have you, to introduce real-time ACH, or they could fail, and it's largely up to them. I think by contrast, in the UK, the market moved more quickly to a better answer for customers. But if you were a startup that was, launching a competitive scheme, and again, the powers that be decided they were going to zig when you were recommending zag. Well, despite all your best work, you lost. So I like the meritocratic approach of letting the marketplace decide, but in a standards-based world, which the heterogeneity of payments requires,
I think the UK and Europe in general might make more progress, as frankly they've demonstrated with things like EMV, because of the ability to legislate from above.
Yeah, I mean, US always argued it was about cost of replacement of POS versus fraud, and that sort of has come crashing down on the US this year, hasn't it? Uday?
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I don't actually believe that Dual is ever going to be successful in the US to create real-time ACH. And part of the reason is that real-time ACH for the banking community in the US requires a massive investment, because the technology that currently in most of the banking sector, 98% of the banking sector in the US has, is not able to cope with anything that's anything close to real-time ACH, because that's STP, and STP is probably a decade too far away for most US institutions. And basically, they have a very strong lobby, and the way the US works is that you pay a bunch of lobbyists in Washington who then lobby Congress, and nothing will ever get through, and that'll be the end of that. And, you know, it reminds me a little bit of Standard Oil and what Standard Oil was many decades ago in the U.S. until the monopoly was broken up. And you sort of have these same dynamics. And so, unfortunately, I hate to say this, but, you know, the U.S. market, you know, revolves a little bit around interests or beneficial interests or whatever you may call it. And it's very, very hard for some of these things to get through, whereas Europe has been very different and has had a little bit more, of an attack scenario, particularly from the people in the antitrust world.
So, David, let's get your last comment on this. Okay. And then my last comment is
we're all futurists here in this panel, right?
Yeah.
And so if something can happen and should happen, it will happen. And so regulation, and this is a global thing, not just in the U.S., but regulation is a temporary roadblock. I mean, just because you have an existing system that is 30, 40 years old does not mean it's going to stay that way. Just because you have entrenched people, look at the broadcast industry. This is all going to change. Banking is going to change. Broadcast is going to change, because it has to change. And it will. The only question is when.
Yeah, I always make the point when I talk to banks about this, and they, banks say, yeah, but the regulator is going to let it happen. I say, regulators don't regulate consumer behavior, and that's what's going to change this industry, and it is changing.
Think
the
crowdfunding?
Industry.
Crowdfunding. Yeah. Who would have thought 5 years ago that crowdfunding would ever be allowed by the SEC? Ever.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so guys, let's be positive. Yeah. Let's look at the future now. 5 to 10 years out. How can London and New York work together to really manage this explosion of fintech growth and these $18 billion of investment we're going to see over the next couple of years? How do we work together to make sure that this is a healthy new industry like Silicon Valley was back in the day? How can we really work together to make sure fintech is overall positive on the global scene?
This is David. I think that, like with Gust, the first winner of the first Great Tech Award, and Seed Invest, our friends with whom we've partnered, the winner of this year's Tech Award, you're going to see companies in London setting up their U.S. operations in New York, because it's the sister city, it's the other financial hub, and similarly for companies like us in New York, you'll see us doing our international base in London. So I think I think you're going to see a lot of companies with their primary offices in both places.
Yeah, and I think we need to support organizations like Innovate Finance and their sisters in the U.S. who are able to create an ecosystem to help companies come over to the respective marketplace, help companies export, and drive more investment into the firms who are ready for their growth. I think we've seen mass proliferation in both marketplaces, and now it's time for growth, for M&A, and to help these companies really get to the next stage where they're looking internationally to export their fintech innovations.
Pascal, you're in Washington. Is there something we can be doing to lobbying Washington to get fintech some more headspace?
Given that I'm a Frenchman in Washington, I'm not sure that I'm the best person to answer U.S. centric lobbying. But Uday and Claire mentioned this a couple of times earlier in the podcast, and they mentioned the international markets and how London is best positioned compared to New York. Yeah, I'll concede one point on looking abroad, whether it's in East Africa or whether it's in Asia. And London may have a leg up here. And I noted that the city of London, I think, has started some type of cooperation with the with Singapore. To me, that's very intriguing. I think that when I look back 5-10 years out, and I think New York, I think the Northeast. I would like more of these initiatives here in the U.S. so that we make sure that we don't miss the next flight, which is increasingly going to be international.
Yeah, instead of just thinking this is the best place in the world, which is sort of the U.S. default setting. Hey, listen, Matt. 2020. What does fintech look like in New York?
I think it's more atomized. I think what we're going to see is these large banks continue to get smaller, not bigger, and many of the functions they currently do being done by startups and venture funded or not. And so we're going to see a proliferation of firms doing things that used to fall under the purview of large financial institutions. That's going to be great for diversity of employment. It's going to be great for folks who invest in the space. I dare say we'll see similar dynamics in London, and it'll be a rising tide for both cities.
Okay, so Uday, you've got 15 seconds.
Yeah, so I'm going to turn it around. I'm going to say very quickly, I think the greatest innovation in financial services is not going to come from London and New York at all. It's going to come from Africa, and it's going to come from Asia, because people are going to find business models that are cheap enough to service those communities.
Yeah,
and that's where it's going to come from.
I think you're absolutely right. Guys, we've run out of time. David Rose, Matt Harris, Pascal Bouvier, Claire Cockett, and Uday Goyal, thanks for joining us on a fantastic show today. It was wonderful. I'm sorry we've run out of time, but we have a new segment up for you guys right now to close out the show. You might have heard something like this on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Here is Ron Shevlin with your moment of snark.
Of the many things that bankers worry about, the threat of non-banks getting into banking is usually at the top of the list. Now, playing on these fears, a leading consulting firm recently asked 3,800 North Americans how likely they would be to bank with a list of non-banks if those firms were to offer banking services. At the top of the list, Square, with 50% of consumers surveyed saying that they would bank with a company who has no physical presence, whose primary service, merchant acquisition and payment processing, is understood by no more than a handful of consumers, and whose consumer-facing product, its mobile wallet, was pulled from the Apple and Google app stores. The survey findings are even more incredulous considering that 2 years ago, less than 1 in 10 U.S. consumers had even heard of Square Wallet, according to ComScore. Now, my own research challenges this affinity for Square. Last year, I asked consumers how well they thought companies like Apple, Amazon, Google, and Square would do at providing mobile shopping apps. 8 of 10 said they didn't know how Square would do, and of those that did have an opinion, about a quarter thought Square would not do a good job. So, where do we stand? Few consumers understand Square's core business. Few know of its mobile wallet, which has been pulled off the market. And many consumers have no opinion on how well Square would do at providing things like mobile shopping apps. Yet we're supposed to believe that 50% of North Americans would be likely to bank with Square if it offered banking services. Yeah, right. Now look, I don't want to dismiss the opportunity that new companies have in providing new banking services if they focus on providing banking services. And I'm certainly not dismissing Square's prospects in payments. But if consumers were really that willing to bank with alternative providers like Square or Costco, don't you think these firms would have gotten into the market by now? After all, researchers have been conducting these studies for years, uncovering opportunities for non-banks to get into banking, opportunities that are unlikely to ever be realized. And that's this week's Moment of Snark on Breaking Banks.
So that puts the wrap to another Breaking Banks episode. I hope you enjoyed the best of show, some of my favorite interviews for the year. We'll, of course, be back again live next week with the show. And just keep in mind that Breaking Banks is the number one fintech radio show on the planet. We go out to 72 countries. You can catch us on iTunes, breakingbanks.com, Voice America Radio, and on Stitcher on the Android platform. Thanks for joining us again. We'll see you in another week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.